I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Arizona Legislature v. Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, a bit of a mouthful, a case that involved a commission supported by voters that drew boundaries for the state's congressional districts. The court upheld the right of the commission to make those determinations in a 5-4 ruling. The legislature had sued, saying it was their job to draw district lines. Well, we wanted to know more about this decision and the precedent, if any, it set for other states, and we asked Michael Lee to join us. He serves as counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program at the New York University Law School. His work focuses on redistricting, voting rights, and elections. Michael Lee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
I should add that the Brennan Center filed an amicus brief in this case, so I just want to make sure our listeners know that. What was at issue in this case?
Well, back in 2000, Arizona voters took back power to draw both congressional and state legislative maps from the legislature. Historically, the legislature, as in many states, drew maps every 10 years. But that led to a lot of partisan gerrymandering, a lot of litigation, and voters were frustrated. And so through a ballot initiative, they took back power from the legislature and gave it to an independent commission to draw maps. And the first cycle in 2001, when they drew maps, everyone was really happy with the maps. In 2011, when the second commission drew maps, so there was a lot more contention, including efforts to remove the chair of the commission. That was unsuccessful. Then the legislature sued and said, under the Constitution's Elections Clause, only a legislature can draw congressional maps, and that was the issue. The counterargument was that, well, under Arizona's constitution, the people have legislative power, and basically that is a form of legislation that is perfectly legitimate.
And who sits or has sat on this independent commission for redistricting in Arizona? Is it pretty much divided among the two parties, the two major parties?
It is. So what happens is people apply, and the Commission on Judicial Nominations prepares a list of people who are qualified, you know, who have the technical and the other expertise to sit on a commission. And then each legislative leader, the majority leader and the minority leader in both the House and the Senate in Arizona, they each pick one person off of that list. Then you have four commissioners. Those four commissioners then select a fifth commissioner who cannot be a member of either party.
And my understanding is that you also can't be a member of the legislature to serve.
That's right. That's right. So this is a citizen commission. The idea is that it's even though people are appointed by legislative leaders, they're a step removed from the legislative process themselves, and that makes it much more independent.
What did and the majority opinion was written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What was her argument? What did she say?
Well, despite the fact that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is thought of and is part of the court's liberal wing, really this is a very conservative opinion because she recognized that for almost 100 years people have been enacting election law changes that impact federal elections through ballot initiatives, and that's not only to create redistricting commissions, as was done in Arizona and California, but also to do things like enact a top-two primary system in Washington State or to eliminate straight-party voting in Ohio, and that this is a long part of American tradition and is in no way is impacted by the Constitution's Elections Clause. In fact, that people have the power to legislate, and that it's particularly important that they have the power to legislate in an area where politicians have a lot of self-interest, where there's a lot of self-dealing, where there's a lot of potential for manipulation of rules, and that this is really important. So it's a very pro-democracy ruling.
Let me read what the Constitution says about, I guess it says this about redistricting. Sometimes when you read this stuff, you're not exactly sure, at least I'm not always exactly sure what the founders intended. But let me read the words. The times, places, and manners of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations. Now, there's nothing in there about commissions that have been voted on by voters in particular states. It sounds like Congress can make these changes, but it's not clear to me
right.
who else can make these changes.
That's right. You know, and that was another part of the argument, which was that the Elections Clause, which you just read, was actually designed to give power to Congress to override states if they were enacting bad laws or bad rules or manipulating the process. Congress could come in and override it. Congress also can make, you know, federal election laws for any number of other reasons. For example, it's used that clause to mandate that the first Tuesday in November is Election Day. It's used that clause to enact the National Voter Registration Act. Congress has the power to regulate federal elections under the clause that you just read. Arizona argued that somehow that clause also was intended to lock in and mean that only the bicameral state legislature that sits in the state capitol can make laws on the, at the state level. And what Justice Ginsburg said in the majority opinion was that's not true. That states make laws through all kinds of mechanisms, including ballot initiatives. And in states where you have ballot initiatives, that's perfectly fine and a legitimate way of making laws.
And it sounded like Chief Justice Roberts was saying, well, if you want to do this and change who draws these district lines, then amend the Constitution.
Well,
not an easy thing to do, though.
Not an easy thing to do, and, you know, I think, you know, some of the other justices, at least in the oral argument, also suggested, like, you know, you could just get Congress to you know, mandate commissions everywhere, which is also, if you look at what's going on in Washington, also not easy to do with this Congress. But again, this is, people have been using ballot initiatives since the early 20th century to do these sorts of things. There were a couple of Supreme Court cases in the around 1920 and 1930 that said, you know, that, for example, that Ohio voters could repeal a redistricting plan that their legislature had enacted, and they could use a ballot initiative to do that. So this is not something that is revolutionary or new. You know, having a redistricting commission in Arizona is relatively new, but people have been using ballot initiatives to govern redistricting for almost 100 years, and it really isn't something that is revolutionary at all.
How important is this case? And it really got overshadowed by the rulings on the Affordable Care Act, on same-sex marriage. Does this sort of meet the criteria in terms of its groundbreakingness?
It really does. I mean, you know, it's a little bit overshadowed in the sense that it's, you know, what you would call a defensive win, right? It doesn't change the law in the way that the Marriage Act did or the marriage ruling did. On the other hand, it certainly places a lot of wind under the wings of reformers in states like Illinois, where there is a severe problem of Democratic gerrymandering. And it's important to stress that gerrymandering is bipartisan in this country. Whichever party is in control tends to want to manipulate the maps to favor their party. But also in Ohio, where, you know, there also is fairly significant gerrymandering. And so I think that this will bolster those efforts to find a way out of the excessive polarization that we have in this country. And I think that sort of underlay a lot of the court's opinion is, like, this is a problem. The court has repeatedly recognized that partisan gerrymandering is a problem. It's not been willing to step in and solve that problem. But through this opinion, it said that the people can, and that's really, really important.
And just to make sure our listeners understand, what you're saying is this really wasn't a ruling about gerrymandering itself. It was really just about the process that some states can use to redistrict.
That's right. The court has repeatedly recognized that partisan gerrymandering is a problem. I think the average person on the street recognizes that partisan gerrymandering is a problem, and that when they look at the maps, they don't seem to make sense. And then when they consider where they're how they're represented in most places, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But the court has not been willing to step in and actually fix that, because they haven't come up with a workable legal standard for what is partisan gerrymandering. But this opinion allows people to take back power and to experiment in sort of a laboratories of democracy way to actually fix this, and as they've done in Arizona and California and about half a dozen other states with respect to congressional redistricting.
So does this decision apply to those states that have some form of commission that redraws or draws district lines?
It does, and it also applies. You know, there are 24 states right now that allow some form of ballot initiative. So, you know, in those states, there are new opportunities for reform. You know, there's an effort in Illinois now to get a proposition on the ballot that would create a redistricting commission. Ohio is voting on a redistricting commission this fall, and there's a new movement to sort of try to add congressional redistricting to that. They didn't the first time because there were concerns about whether that would be constitutional. The Supreme Court now has said it would be perfectly constitutional to create a congressional redistricting commission. And so there are new efforts on the part of reformers in Ohio to create a redistricting commission there. There are similar efforts in South Dakota and, you know, lots of other states. And so it really, I think, is an exciting moment, and it really could be really empowering to people, again, because almost everyone recognizes that there is a problem with polarization in this country today.
And states without commissions just continue as they have in the past?
Well, they would for now. You know, again, you know, there are efforts in some states to try to change that. Not all states allow ballot initiatives. So, for example, Texas does not allow a ballot initiative. Oh. And so, you know, any right now redistricting in Texas would have to continue being done by the legislature. But in those states where there is an effort or the opportunity for a ballot initiative, I think you're going to see a lot more movement there. You might see a lot more movement on the part of, you know, funders and you know, people who care about this. And you know, there are broad coalitions. The business community in Illinois is a major supporter of redistricting reform, as are minority groups and others. And so, you know, it really is a very broad bipartisan coalition in most of the places where it's happened. So.
Final question. I mean, was this as you read the opinions, a fight over what the word legislature means?
It was sort of a fight over what the word legislature means, and it's sort of awkward. You know, the dissent and Chief Justice Roberts and the other dissenters took a very formalistic view of what legislature meant, and it really if you look back, though, it actually is fairly odd. If you go back to the founding era, legislatures looked nothing like legislatures look like today. Many of them, you know, there wasn't separation of powers. Many of the structures were completely different. A couple of states actually operated under their old royal colonial charters until the mid-19th century. And so, you know, the idea that we have some kind of fixed concept of what a legislature is just kind of nutty. It doesn't kind of make sense. You know, that was sort of the debate, and I think Justice Ginsburg had the better part of that because her argument was really like how state legislate has evolved from the very beginning of the country. So it really was sort of a strange debate.
Well, on that note, Michael Lee, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times and helping us understand this decision that kind of got overshadowed by some other decisions in the last couple of days.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Michael Lee, counsel for the Brennan Center for Justice's Democracy Program at NYU Law School. And coming up after this very short break, we will talk about Chris Christie. He wants to be president of the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Ballot Talks on Radio Times.
America is tired of hand-wringing and indecisiveness and weakness in the Oval Office. We need to have strength and decision-making and authority back in the Oval Office. And that is why today I am proud to announce my candidacy for the Republican nomination for President of the United States of America.
That was New Jersey Governor Chris Christie earlier this week at an event at his high school. He has his work cut out for him. There are more than a dozen candidates vying for the Republican nomination. His popularity in New Jersey has taken a nosedive recently, and it looks like he's not too popular with Republicans, at least not so far. 55% of Republicans said they would never vote for Christie in a new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll. Well, we're going to talk about Chris Christie in this portion of Ballot Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and we have two guests who have joined us. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Matt Katz. He writes the Christy Tracker blog for WNYC and for New Jersey Public Radio. He's got a book he is writing about Governor Christie called America's Governor, Chris Christie's Bridge to Redemption, and it is published on January 5th of 2016. Matt Katz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us and joining us by telephone is Tom Moran, editorial page editor for the Star-Ledger. And Tom Moran, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Let me begin with you, Matt. And we have some more clips I want to play during the hour, including a kind of a greatest hits of Chris Christie losing his temper. But listening in, to this his announcement earlier this week, is this a kind of kinder, gentler version of himself he was pitching?
To a certain extent, he's going to be running by owning his personality. He actually refers to some of his more famous encounters with constituents and reporters in New Jersey on the campaign trail, on the presidential campaign trail. But he does adjust it somewhat when he's up in states like New Hampshire and Iowa. I've seen him in these town hall meetings in New Hampshire, and that's really the focus of his campaign. He wants to win voter by voter in New Hampshire through these town hall meetings that he did so successfully in New Jersey. And it's a mellower Chris Christie there. He's not as apt to cut the head off a heckler or somebody who challenges him. He's a little bit folksier. So it's a slight adjustment, but don't be mistaken. His personality, he is owning it. This is what he thinks is his greatest strength. He thinks he comes off as more of a real person, more of a relatable person than any of the other hundreds of Republicans who are in this race. So he's going to try to use it to his advantage.
Tom, do you think he can use his personality as a selling point?
Well, partly, and he's trying to spin it that way. It is true what Matt says, though. We're at a town hall in New Hampshire, and this guy in the audience started heckling him. Not quite heckling, but interrupting him when he was pitching his Social Security plan. And the guy repeated, and everybody in New Jersey, all the reporters out there were like covering our ears, and like, here it comes, he's going to kill this guy. And he was like, oh, no, you know, it's fine, I understand your objection, and he waited. So he's definitely putting it under new control. And on Matt Lauer this week, he tried to spin it this way. You know, he said, it's a controlled anger. I'm angry about the fact that taxpayers are being ripped off. I'm angry that urban kids can't get a good education. I think America wants someone who's willing to fight for that. So in his version, he's spinning it to be sort of righteous anger. It's not about being a bully and beating up the little kid in the schoolyard. It's about, you know, really fighting against taking truth to power and being angry about injustice.
Do you think Tommy can reframe it that way? Only because, you know, there's such a trail of his comments that will dog him, it seems.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to convince everybody, but I think it's probably his best shot. And that does speak to something that is appealing about the guy, is that he has genuine passion. But we've seen too many cases where it's just bullying and it's repugnant. And you have, like, you know, the FDU poll recently in New Jersey said 39% of people don't like everything about him. I mean, that's pretty intense. You have another 23% that doesn't like his policies, so it adds up to over 60. But there's such a visceral dislike of the guy now. I'm seeing it in the comments that people place under columns I write, too. It's a dramatic change in tone.
Do you see that as well, Matt?
For sure. There was a new poll out this morning that 76% of New Jerseyans don't think he cares about New Jersey anymore and that he just cares about his own political future. His popularity, his standing in New Jersey, even among Republicans, the dramatic drop in it is incredible. I mean, this is a guy who is at, you know, approaching 70% approval ratings in 2012. He won re-election in 2013 with 22 points. He was the front runner for the Republican nomination for sure by every poll out there in December and 2013, and then in January 2014. And here we are a year and a half later, and he's barely polling in the top 10% of all the Republican contenders. It's a dramatic drop.
And asking or talking about New Jersey, is it that he has been out of the state so much that people in New Jersey feel abandoned by their governor?
That's what they tell pollsters. I mean, he's been out of the state almost half of the days for all or part of almost half of the days in the last year and a half, laying the groundwork for a presidential campaign. And there's also just less governing going on. You know, he was doing town hall meetings in New Jersey every week almost every week in his first term, pushing plans to cap property taxes or to change the public employee pension and health benefit system. And he had mixed success, but some certainly some significant legislative success that he dealt with Democrats on. And now I talked to Steve Sweeney, the Senate president in New Jersey, a couple weeks ago. This was a guy who was his governing partner. This was the guy who Christie used to hold up as a symbol of how he was able to get things done, unlike President Obama in Washington, D.C. Sweeney says he hasn't talked to him anytime recently, that they haven't seen each other. He couldn't remember the last time they'd even sat down and seen each other. So, you know, New Jerseyans appear to have felt that he's abandoning them. That's what they're telling pollsters.
Well, let me play another clip from his announcement. And again, this is Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey making his presidential campaign announcement on Tuesday, where he outlined what he saw as a number of his accomplishments. Let's give it a listen.
We rolled up our sleeves and we went to work and we balanced six budgets in a row. We've refused to raise taxes on the people of this state for 6 years. We made the hard decisions that had to be made to improve our education system. We reformed tenure for the first time in 105 years. We made the difficult decisions to reform pensions and health benefits and continue that fight today. We have stood together against each and every person, every cynic who said, why are you wasting your time? This state is not governable. The last 6 years we proved not only can you govern this state, you can lead it to a better day. And that's what we've done together.
Tom Moran, is that correct?
About half and half. I mean, he did balance the budgets, but you have no choice. The Constitution demands it. Corzine balanced all the budgets, too. What Christie has done that's a little sneaky is put a lot of those costs into the future by failing to invest in the pension and by borrowing more to finance roads rather than impose a tax, gas tax. So he's pushing a lot of costs to the future. He's doing things like raising bus fares and toll fares. It now costs $15 to cross the Hudson to get into Manhattan, which I still am stunned at. Mm. And so he's finding other ways. He's got a surcharge on utility bills that he's been raiding for over $1 billion. And that's a very regressive way to raise money. It's not called a tax, so it doesn't have the T word. But I'd say there's other ways. The balance the budget thing strikes me as phony. The tenure reform was a significant accomplishment. No new taxes, if you accept the fact that there's some leakage there through these other means, is an accomplishment, and it's a change of pace in New Jersey. So I'd say half and half.
Tom, let me quote you. You wrote something earlier this week about Chris Christie. You say, don't believe a word the man says. He's been lying on steroids lately on core issues like Bridgegate guns and the cozy personal friendship with his buddy, the King of Jordan. You calling him a liar?
Yeah, we thought about that carefully, too, and the column discusses what kind of, what's that?
I said, I bet you did.
Yeah.
Or your lawyers did.
You know, after all our years of covering the guy, what do we know that the rest of America might not appreciate as much? And we thought about the other big possibility was we're going to write about what a mess New Jersey was. Because a problem solver, I think he was in his first 2 years, but we've seen a pretty dramatic return on that. And we were going to write that. Then we thought, no, you know what? Those things will come up. What we really can add is that he does constantly lie. I named five or six big examples. Matt has one. I don't think you called it a lie, Matt, but you have another good one. I thought about his claim that U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman and his own investigator, Randy Mastro, came to the same conclusions about Bridgegate. Mm. And that's just not true. I mean, Bill Baroni was indicted by Fishman and cleared by Mastro. And Mastro said there's no evidence of what their motive was, and Fishman said it was political revenge. But there's a long list of those kind of things. The King of Jordan is my friend because he met him at a dinner party once, and now he takes his whole family to a luxury hotel in the desert worth over $30,000, the bill for the hotel. It goes on and on. I never signed a gun law. He signed three. Planned Parenthood, he said, all for years he's been saying, this is a worthy program and I'm only doing it because we can't afford it. And now he's out on the trail telling people, this proves my pro-life credentials. These go on and on. I mean, I've got a whole truckload of them. I didn't even have space in the column to list them all.
And you think that's unusual in the world of campaign politics, Tom?
Yeah, I think it's unusual in its degree, in its frequency, the audacity with which he lies. When he ran in 2009, he wrote a letter to all the unions that were worried he might try to cut their pension and health benefits. And he said that anybody who tells you that is not only lying, it's beneath contempt, and these benefit programs are sacred to me. And then he made the centerpiece of his first year in office was reducing pension and health benefits, exactly mm-hmm. what they feared. He does it with no qualification, with no, you know, hesitation. You know, his eyes don't wander, his hand doesn't shake. He's just it's almost pathological, if you ask me.
What do you think, Matt Katz?
He has to be held up to a great deal of scrutiny on this because his campaign motto is literally telling it like it is. That's his whole shtick, is that I give it to you straight. I'm not going to dance around. And that's why, you know, examining whether some of these things are lies is so important for the press to be doing right now, I think. What I've noticed in terms of a shift in the way he talks about things is a move toward the right. On guns, he used to say he supported New Jersey's tough gun laws. Now he said this morning at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire, I wouldn't have signed some of these gun laws. He called some gun proposals that are gun control proposals currently in the New Jersey legislature. He called them crazy on Fox News. So he's moved to the right. He's moved to the right on abortion. As Tom said, he used to say he. The night before his announcement, he signed a veto of $7.5 million for women's health clinics, much of which goes to Planned Parenthood. And he does this every year. He vetoes $7.5 million line item out of the budget. And like he did every year, he said it was because of budgetary reasons. The money is redirected elsewhere, is spent on women's health and other programs. And then what happens? He goes on Fox News the next night. He announces his candidacy for president. Goes on Fox News the next night with Sean Hannity. He's asked, why should we believe that you're a real Republican? He's like, well, I'm a true conservative. I'm pro-life. I vetoed Planned Parenthood money. I've done it every year. And that's in within 24 hours. So I think that's part of what Tom's getting to in terms of truth testing him.
And who are we talking about? Hold on one second. I just need to reintroduce the two of you. We are talking about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He made his presidential announcement earlier this week, talking with Matt Katz and also Tom Moran. And we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email. RadioTimes@WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. More than a dozen Republicans say they want to be president of the United States. Governor Christie making noises over the last couple of months about his interest in running for the White House, and he made it official earlier this week. Tom, you wanted to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
No,
I think that all politicians move right and flip-flop, and they all break promises now and then. Circumstances can change. And, you know, I respect the fact that they have to, when they are running New Jersey and then have to speak to the national audience, they're going to move right. Lying is something different to me and beyond that. It's when you say something you know is not true for a political purpose. So we didn't include in the lies things like the broken promise over pensions where he said he would put billions into the fund and then did not. Because circumstances changed. The economy slowed down. He didn't have as much money as he thought. So I wouldn't call that a lie. And flip-flop, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody does it. It seems too harsh to call that a lie. But where Christie distinguishes himself is things, you know, where he's saying things that are flat out not true. I mean, another one is on the pension thing. He said, the Democrats gave me a budget that shorted the pension fund. So when they filed suit against me, they're suing themselves. And that, again, is just flagrantly not true. The Democrats presented a budget that included full pension payments, and he line item vetoed it out, along with the tax increases that supported that payment. Now, it's impossible for me to believe that he doesn't know that. He signed that. He signed these gun laws. He made the claim about the King of Jordan. And they all serve as political purpose.
I wonder to you, Matt, we haven't really talked about Bridgegate, which, of course, has taken up, you know, so much press time.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be the event that really caused his popularity to tumble, at least on the national stage. Do you think that's true?
To some extent, it's a bit of a puzzle because that was clearly the tipping point when his popularity dropped substantially. That's when it started in January 2013 when the smoking gun came out about Bridgegate and indicated that his administration was involved. But when you go to Iowa and New Hampshire and you go
right.
and talk to Republicans and you ask them about Chris Christie, they don't bring up the bridge. They bring up the fact that he cozied up to President Obama after Superstorm Sandy in the middle of the 2012 presidential election. But they don't bring up the bridge. What I've come to think is that the negative nature of the coverage, the fact that the guy who's up there telling you, I tell you the truth, I'm the former federal prosecutor who brings, you know, strong, tough, clean government to New Jersey. That all that whole shtick sort of was the facade started to crumble because of the continued coverage of this story and the fact that it was revealed that his top associates, several of them, were involved in this crazy plan to shut down.
And it is a crazy plan,
it's
right?
The busiest bridge in the world. Totally crazy. And the mayor there, you go back and you read some of these emails, as I've done many times, and you know the mayor there is freaking out. There's a public safety emergency.
This is the mayor of Fort Lee,
Fort Lee, right. And Christie's top people, his top appointees are straight up ignoring his pleas. They're blowing off his phone calls, blowing off his emails. Something seriously amiss was happening. And I think there's a sense of that that must have gotten into the bloodstream out there in America. And then you have now a very competitive field, and Republicans view him as damaged. And they say, why would I go for this guy if there's, you know, 13, 14 other options out there? And I think that's what's been, you know, contributed to his serious drop in the polls.
I mean, Tom, we're almost up on a break here, but does it raise questions about his hiring policies?
It does. And there are really only two possibilities for Christie. He can say, I didn't know what was going on with my senior staff, which makes him clueless, or I did know what was going on, which makes him corrupt. So there's no real good out for him. But Matt's right about how this resonates in New Jersey more than it does out of the state. Maybe because these four hours in gridlock 4 days in a row, and they wanted to keep going. How long would they have gone? I mean, you had kids in school buses and ambulances. And to people here, that was way psycho.
Way psycho. Just, I mean, and it sounds petty and vindictive. I mean, if what we believe so far is true, is that it was to punish the mayor of Fort Lee for not supporting the governor of New Jersey.
That's what the federal prosecutor has determined, that this, we didn't know for all this for a long time, like why this happened. They said it was because he did not endorse Chris Christie in his reelection.
And that,
what amazes me about that, Marty, if I could, is this isn't a means to pressure him to get the endorsement. This is after he decided not to endorse this as punishment.
Ah, well, and that's Tom Moran. He's editorial page editor for the Star Ledger. Also with us is Matt Katz. He writes the Christie Tracker blog for WNYC, one of our sister stations here for NPR. And also he writes for New Jersey Public Radio. And we are talking about Governor Chris Christie and his bid for the White House. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. Why Radio Times, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times, and again, we're talking about Chris Christie, his announcement earlier this week that he is running for president, one of a slew of Republicans who want to be president of the United States. I do want to play a montage we put together yesterday in which Chris Christie was accused of being a bully during his time as governor of New Jersey. Let's give it a listen.
You know, Tom, you must be the thinnest skinned guy in America, because you think that's a confrontational tone. Then, you should really see me when I'm pissed.
After you graduate from law school, you conduct yourself like that in a courtroom, your rear end's going to get thrown in jail, idiot.
Did I say on topic? Are you stupid? Thank you all very much, and I'm sorry for the idiot over there. Take care. I'm glad you had your day to show off, but we're the ones who are here to actually do the work. So turn around, get your 15 minutes of fame, and then maybe take your jacket off, roll up your sleeves, and do something for the people of this state. But until that time, sit down and shut up.
Talking with Tom Moran and Matt Katz. Tom, you are the Tom that he was referring to at the very top of that clip.
I know, I'm so honored. I was early on, you know, I helped launch his YouTube career.
Yes, you
but,
did.
You know, I don't think he was mad then. I didn't, you know, we at that point, we were still talking, and we joked about it. I didn't take it as a personal assault like some of the other clips in there. But maybe that's because I'm in the game and, you know, we go at each other all the time.
But as you say, this is sort of the YouTube hits of Chris Christie. This will dog him, it seems, Tom Moran, calling people idiots, telling them to shut up, telling them that they're stupid. It's just hard to imagine that that's going to play well among a core group of Republican voters.
Well, I think a big problem for Christie is that if he does get traction, he's worth attacking suddenly. His opponents aren't buying ads that run these clips because it's not worth it when he's getting 4% of the vote and is out of the top 10. But if he does get traction in New Hampshire, as his sort of last-ditch effort is, they will. And there's not only his behavior, but there's the record in New Jersey. So he's immensely vulnerable to 30-second spots.
Well, you could call it, Matt, you could call it bold, you could call it brash, you could call it belligerent. I mean, there are many ways that you could, I guess, depending on what side of the fence of Chris Christie you're on, how you hear those kinds of comments.
Some people find it charming. And I actually think that some people around the country find it charming. I've seen he now talks about the sit down and shut up comment around the country, and he tells the story, and, you know, this guy was heckling me, and, you know, if some, I'm going to tell you like it is. So I told him to sit down and shut up. I remember at the 2012 convention, he was speaking to a breakfast meeting of South Carolina Republicans, and he said, if you don't go and do what you got to do on election day, listen, I'm from New Jersey. I'm going to come back here, and I'm going to take care of you. He made this like clear mafia reference that he was going to literally like hunt them down and bury them if they didn't vote as he told them to. I mean, like just owning the bully thing, and people loved it so much. They were laughing. They mobbed him on the way out the door. They couldn't continue the rest of the program because he was such a popular personality. Now, does that translate into actual votes? Do people want somebody like that negotiating with Vladimir Putin? I don't know. But
some people might.
Some people, exactly right. And maybe in a very crowded race, enough people want it, and that he could actually win a plurality of votes in a place like New Hampshire. He doesn't need 51% in any of these primary states. He just needs enough to, you know, clear the rest of the field.
Let me play another clip, and then Tom, we'll hear from you. And this is another clip. This is part of Governor Christie's presidential campaign announcement earlier this week.
I am not running for president of the United States as a surrogate for being elected prom king of America. I am not looking to be the most popular guy who looks in your eyes every day and tries to figure out what you want to hear, say it, and then turn around and do something else. When I stand up on a stage like this in front of all of you, there is one thing you will know for sure. I mean what I say, and I say what I mean, and that's what America needs right now.
I mean, Tommy has a way with words. You got to give him that.
Absolutely. And I was going to just to circle back on the bully comments. Sometimes it's very appealing. I would say one that appealed to me personally was get the hell off the beach during the hurricane. You know, I think he spoke to a lot of people there where it's like, you idiots are endangering yourself, which is fine, but you're also endangering the rescue crews who are going to have to come get you. And I think he spoke to an anger about that was useful. He definitely has charisma and a way with words. And, you know, so there's no question it has its appeal. If he can spin it, if he can control the obnoxious side of it and hold on to the sort of, you know, very strong and robust side of it, it might not be a problem. It might actually help him.
And man, it seems that the candidates in there, I think there's some more that are going to be tossing their hats into the ring, jockeying to appear in this first debate. I think it's going to be hosted by Fox probably in August. They're only going to take the top 10. So the people in the, I guess, the bottom rungs, and I do believe that includes Chris Christie.
Right now he's on the cusp. He's at like number 10 right now. Yeah.
Okay, so jockeying to get themselves catapulted into 8, 9, maybe 10.
Right, he's got the polling to determine who makes the cut for this big debate will be at the end of July. So he really needs to make up a little bit of ground in order to secure his spot in that debate, because that debate is very important for him, because he has a lot of confidence in his debating abilities, and he thinks that once he gets on the stage and he starts firing some attacks and deflecting attacks against him, and maybe gets into the specifics on policy more than other candidates, which so far he's actually done on the campaign trail. He's kind of really delved, given a specific policy proposals on certain things. He thinks in that debate he can really shine, and that's going to be a very important moment for him. Now, if he doesn't get into the debate, that's going to be a problem for him. I don't know what he then does, how he pivots from that.
Tommy, interesting to see Donald Trump and Chris Christie on the debate stage together, don't you think?
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, people do pair those two, but I think it's really rough on Christie, who's a serious politician and not a racist lunatic like Trump. I mean, you know, I have my criticism of Christie, but my God.
Yeah. You took my words right out of my mouth.
They're friends, too, by the way. Trump was in the front row at his 2010 inauguration. Yeah, they
it's a cause for concern, right?
Let me get Alexa from, looks like, South Jersey to join us in Radio Times. Yes. Hi, Alexa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I am a teacher in South Jersey, and I actually moved out here from California for many reasons, but partially because I knew New Jersey was a great place to be a teacher and raise a family. I'm calling because I agree with many of the things that your panelists have said. said, and I think you referenced this earlier, I have trouble imagining Christie playing on the West Coast and in the Midwest and in so many places where the brusque New Jersey attitude is kind of laughable. I know you referenced earlier people liked it, but I have trouble seeing him flying in the middle of the country or even the West Coast. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, what do you think, Matt? And then I'll toss it to you, Tom.
A couple of years ago, Meg Whitman was running for governor of California, and he was out in California, and she was getting heckled. And they Christie was on stage with her. They were doing an event together. And Christie took the microphone from her, and he got like inches away from this guy and got in his face, and he, you know, forced him to sit down through the power of his booming voice, and the crowd went nuts. Now, so again, I don't know if like nuts in a good way. They were very excited and were and Meg Whitman has said since that she was like it was a chivalrous moment that like he actually, you know, stood up for her and successfully defused the situation by returning the guy's aggression with even more New Jersey aggression. So I don't know if that translates into votes, but in the moment, it was very successful. We'll see. I mean, I tend to think that enough people are going to like it that he can, you know, be somewhat successful with it.
But it seems to me, Tom, it depends who the target is or who the person is who is going after him. I mean, if it's, you know, if I can put it this way, a little old lady, I mean, I don't think that plays particularly well. If it's Donald Trump, maybe a different story.
Yeah, I think that's true. It really depends how he does it. If he's standing up, say, to the teachers' union over tenure, which he did a lot of this, or if he's saying, as I said, get the hell off the beach, where he's sort of standing up for rescue workers, I think people might like it. If he's saying, sit down and shut up, or if he's calling a Navy SEAL fresh back from Iraq, he's calling the guy an idiot.
Ooh.
I don't think people like that. So he's got, you know, he's got to be careful. He's got to be disciplined, which has not really been a strong suit of his, so that's a challenge.
Yeah, go ahead.
Tom and I often disagree about this. I actually think he's more disciplined than he gets credit for. In the big press conference he did after Bridgegate and went on nearly 2 hours, he didn't yell at a single reporter. A reporter asked a question that was identical to the question I had just asked, which normally would get an explosion from the podium. I mean, Christie does not like that, and he just calmly, in this moment, because he knew he couldn't, because it was this big Bridgegate mea culpa press conference, he calmly responded and repeated the answer that he had just given me. I've seen him. He likes to say he has more than one club in the bag, and I tend to agree with that. I mean, he made a grown man cry at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire, not because he yelled at him. This was yesterday. Not because he yelled at him, but because he told this touching story he always tells about his mother on her deathbed. So he can shift gears more than I think he gets credit for.
Let me read an email from Pam. She says, I doubt that Hillary Clinton could get the Democratic nomination if she were significantly overweight. I noticed that Jeb Bush has dropped some pounds. Why is Christie's bulk not an issue? Is it off the table? And if so, why? Tom, do you think this should be an issue?
No. I think we should have full disclosure of his health reports to see if he has asthma, and no doubt his weight causes various health problems. But No, I think it's really a sort of crazy distraction. And Christie critics who go after that, I think, are a little desperate.
Mm. And I mean, he has lost weight, man. I mean, you've been following him around for some time now.
He has lost some weight due to a lap band surgery a couple of years ago, a significant amount of weight. I mean, he's certainly, I don't think he would argue with the fact that he's overweight. But he gets a lot of abuse about it. I actually think that if he got the kind of abuse, if he was a woman and he got the kind of abuse that he gets on Twitter and from headline writers, particularly tabloids in New York, it would actually cause more controversy. I think the fact that he's a man and he's heavy, makes it somehow okay. I think, you know, although I find it really kind of reprehensible the way people handle his weight, I don't think it's necessarily an issue if he's president, as long as, you know,
his
he releases his health records and his health is good. But I will say I do find it perplexing that he allows himself sometimes to be the butt of fat jokes. He twice on late night shows, first on Letterman and then on Fallon, he ate a donut on Letterman, and then several months ago he ate ice cream on Fallon to play into some, you know, set up staged fat joke skit they were doing. And that I don't necessarily understand. And it seems to just, you know, perpetuate this thing. He's at his best, though, when he talks about his weight in a way that is populist, where he talks about this is a problem that many Americans have, and I'm continuing to struggle with it. And he's very effective. And I think he could be an appealing figure on the national stage, political or not, by using his weight as an issue to relate to other people.
We have an email from Arnold. I'll toss this to you, Tom. Says, can you envision a Christie Trump or a Trump Christie ticket?
No. Quite to keep it simple, absolutely not.
Who are his big donors, Tom? I mean, you know, you mentioned the who are backing his campaign?
Matt probably knows this better than I do. Ken Langone from Home Depot is a big one, but a lot of his big people in New Jersey have gone with Bush. You know, his good friend Joe Carillos, who ran for Senate against Menendez, broke with Christie and sided with Bush. Who's the big fundraiser down the shore? Larry Bathgate, traditional Christie supporter, mainstream Republican guy, has also gone with Bush. Bush held fundraisers in New Jersey and New York that a lot of the Republican establishment have gone to. Hmm. So we've come a long way. When Mitt Romney ran in 2012, Christie issued an order that he cannot raise money from Republicans in New Jersey until Christie gives him the signal. And Romney's people were deeply offended by that, but they obeyed it. You know, Christie used to have a rock hard grip on New Jersey Republicans, and that's gone.
Well, and it's interesting, and some have said, Matt, that in 2012, I mean, he says he wasn't ready, but some felt that his star was really on the rise in 2012. Today, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, they were begging him to get into the race in 2012. This was actually toward the end of 2011 when all the big establishment Republicans in the country, from the hog and ethanol barons in Iowa who determined the front runners in that race, to Henry Kissinger, to all these big Wall Street billionaires, put him in a room and were saying, please run for president, please run for president. He said no. I think he anticipated that those people would be with him in 2016 if Obama won again. And sure enough, they are not with him. Many of those people are not with him. There's Ken Langone. There's a couple of other people, but he's lost a lot of that money. He's running an underdog, underfunded campaign. They're hoping to raise about $20 million by the end of the year. And they said they have donations already so far this week from all 50 states. But he is not going to have nearly the kind of money that people like Jeb Bush and probably Scott Walker and Marco Rubio have. He has one wild card. He might get Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, and he might have some people out in Silicon Valley don't traditionally support Republicans who might be in his corner.
Oh, that's interesting. Tom, we're almost out of time here. What do you think Christie has to do to get in this top 10 tier?
Well, I think he really his only hope is if somebody like Bush crumbles, and then there's some room for the moderate, reasonable guy who can cut bipartisan deals. You know, that was his pitch in 2012, and add on a heavy dose of charisma. You know, he has to perform well. But right now, that same pitch doesn't work as well, partly because Bush has occupied that ground, and partly because New Jersey is now stuck in a Washington-style partisan standoff on a range of issues. So the messenger is not as effective with that. Mm. But I think that's got to be his only hope. I'm the guy who can really campaign. I can beat Hillary because I'm so charming, and I'm going to be a reasonable mainstream guy, so the party establishment and the Wall Street people will give him lots of money.
Well, we've been talking about Governor Chris Christie, his bid for the White House. Tom Moran, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. Editorial page editor for the Star Ledger. Also with us, Matt Katz. Thank you, Matt, for joining us as well.
Of course, Marty. Thanks.
And let me say the name of Matt's book correctly. It's called American Governor, and it will be out on January 5th, 2016. He writes the Christie Tracker, which is also a podcast, and you can listen to that here at, I guess, at Newsworks here at WHYY. You think I would know these things? Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.